Rock and Roll Rebels, and welcome to another episode of Ramble On with Rosie. We are going to discuss some happy and sad events of the previous days in the world of music. We'll get the unhappiness out of the way first and acknowledge the passing of Graham Edge of the Moody Blues, who played drums on every single Moody Blues album from their early stuff when it was Go Now, prior to Justin Hayward, all the way up to the last album. So, very key figure in the band, and losing him was just, you know, very saddening, especially as a huge Moody Blues fan. Like, if you have listened to my episodes, Ramblin' Rose, which is autobiographical, or my episode Days of Future Past that I did, you understand I'm a huge Moody Blues fan. You can go check out my Instagram. There's been a Movember vinyl challenge all month long, and I think I've already used 2 or 3 Moody Blues albums as selections for the various daily challenges. So, huge Moody Blues fan, so it's really sad to lose Graham Edge, especially considering while he didn't do a lot of songwriting, he is responsible for most of the poetic interludes on Moody Blues albums. So, everything from, like, the intro on Threshold of a Dream or Children's Children, where it's like, I think I am, therefore I must be, I think, or the poetry bits on Days of Future Past, those were his contributions to the band. So, a sad loss there, and then just a couple days ago, losing the fantastic photographer Mick Rock, who shot so many iconic shots from the 70s, be it album covers or just really famous well-known photographs, especially as the chief photographer for David Bowie around the Ziggy Stardust era. So, and I didn't realize that Mick Rock is responsible for a couple of my most favorite photograph album covers. I have a Rory Gallagher t-shirt, which is the album cover for his debut album, printed on a black shirt, and it's, I mean, that photo is one of my favorite photos of Rory. Didn't realize it was Mick Rock who'd taken it. He actually took the photos for the album covers of Rory's first 4 albums, and he also did the cover design and photography for Mott the Hoople's All the Young Dudes. So he just did a lot of things that, like, if you're into classic music at all, which I assume you are because you're listening to me, you've probably seen half dozen photos by him, whether you know it or not. I mean, he did the cover for End of the Century, for crying out loud. Like, he may be referred to as the man who shot the 70s, but I feel like more noteworthy than that even is he's the man who got the Ramones to take off their leather jackets. That is an accomplishment, because they're just in their t-shirts on the cover for End of the Century, and the Ramones, pretty much their skin was their leather jackets. They're hardly ever seen without them, especially for album covers. So, losing those two luminaries was, you know, sad. But we are not here to discuss the dead so much as the living, because on November 20th, 1947, one Joseph Fiddler was born. And his father was a flight instructor in the United States Air Force and died in a plane crash in 1949, before Joe was even 2 years old. Later, Joseph's mother married a man whose last name was Walsh. And, well, the rest is history, and we'll get on to that history, but as was more commonplace at the time, he took his stepdad's last name, same way that Stevie Van Zandt did, which, incidentally, Stevie will be next week's topic, because his birthday is just 2 days after Joe Walsh's, well, 2 days in about 4 years, but we'll get to that. So, we will be discussing my favorite E Streeter next week, but for context now, it was more common in the 50s, as is exampled by both Joe Walsh and Stevie Van Zandt, to like take your stepdad's last name if you were still pretty young when your mom remarried. So, Joseph Fiddler became Joseph Fiddler Walsh, retaining his birth surname as his middle name. And his mom is where some of the musical influence comes from because she was a classically trained pianist. So that's like his early origins. At age 10, Joe Walsh got his first guitar, and upon learning Walk Don't Run by the Ventures, decided that that was something he really wanted to pursue potentially as a career. Now, backstory on this, personally for me, my brother was learning how to play guitar, and one of the first songs he was learning was Walk Don't Run. And I cannot tell you how much I loathe that song to the depths of my soul. Like, I have trauma from hearing this song so many times. I don't know that I've listened to it since, because my brother was just playing it over and over and over and over until I wanted to scream and throw a blender at his head. So, God bless Joe Walsh's siblings, if he had any, for having to put up with that. But unlike my brother, Joe Walsh went on to become a very proficient, excellent, and creative guitar player, which is what we're here for today. So, he's learning how to play guitar. His family moves to a couple different places because Joe was born in Kansas, but they lived in Ohio and New York. And he ended up attending high school in Montclair, New Jersey, and played oboe in the band at Montclair High School. And he ends up graduating, which is shocking for a rock star, right? And goes to college, majoring in English with a minor in music. He was in a local bar band called the Measles, which did some songs for Ohio Express. Now, I looked into Ohio Express, and it wasn't so much as a band as it was like a name for kind of like a local talent agency who would like put out various local bands' records under the artist name of Ohio Express. So, I don't know, like a band corporation? I'm not sure what the term would be for that. Their most well-known song to come out of Ohio Express would be Yummy Yummy Yummy. So, kind of a one-hit wonder kind of consortium of bands with various songs. So he was attending Kent State, and he was also present at the Kent State Massacre, though I believe that was after he had dropped out from classes. It's very misleading, because, like, either he went to college really late, or the dates are a little messed up, because the Kent State Massacre happened in 1970. And, but from the quote, it sounds like Joe Walsh was enrolled at the time because his quote says, "Being at the shootings really affected me profoundly. I decided that maybe I don't need a degree that bad." And after one semester, he dropped out of college. But with it being 1970, he'd be like 22, at least 21. It seems a bit late to be a freshman in college, so I don't know where the discrepancy is. I'd like an explanation, and I can't give y'all one because I don't know what the answer is. But he was in attendance at the shooting. And in 1968, so 2 years prior to the Kent State Massacre, Joe Walsh joined the James Gang. He was actually a replacement for guitarist Glenn Schwartz, but there was definitely a revolving door at the James Gang because in the following less than 6 months after Joe Walsh joined, like three other band members like left. Like one left, one came and left, and another original band member kind of left. So very crazy fluctuating times in the band. The worst one of those departing band members would be the second guitarist, who, of all gigs to pick to decide that he wasn't going to play, the James Gang was supposed to play in Detroit, opening for Cream. So, not just anybody, like, it's a pretty prominent gig. You're opening for essentially the first supergroup that's widely what Cream is considered to be, was like the first super group, because they had Jack Bruce, who had been in other bands prior, and Ginger Baker, and of course Eric Clapton, who had been in, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And, was already, I think the Clapton is God thing was well underway by now, so lots of, publicity here, and their second guitarist decides he's not gonna play the gig, which makes them a trio opening for the Ultimate Power Trio. And they decided that they were better off without this dude and better off as a trio. So they stuck with the party of three and apparently did at least decent opening for Cream, so that was good. And then the James Gang would go on to open for various other bands, including Three Dog Night, Grand Funk Railroad, Humble Pie, and the Kinks. More importantly than all those, not that those aren't important, they opened for Led Zeppelin in 1969. And Page and Walsh had been acquainted since the latter days of the Yardbirds, when Joe had attended some gigs when the Yardbirds were only a foursome, so after Jeff Beck had left, but before they completely dissolved and then rose phoenix-like from the ashes as the new Yardbirds, who would go on to become called Led Zeppelin. So Joe Walsh had attended, and the James Gang had even opened for the Yardbirds when they were just the quartet. And John Paul Jones and the American Navy apparently was also at some of those Yardbird gigs, which is pretty cool. I didn't realize this band existed, that John Paul Jones had done anything prior to Led Zeppelin that wasn't just session work. And obviously, I can't really find any evidence on this other than the claims of Fox, who's a member of the James Gang, because every time you Google John Paul Jones and the American Navy, all you're going to get is historical facts about American naval officer John Paul Jones in the American Revolutionary War, which is not what I'm looking for. Very unhelpful. So I'm gonna have to take it on the word of the guy from the James Gang that John Paul Jones had a band that was opening for the Yardbirds. This guy's sole word alone. That's all I could find on it. But on that particular day that the James Gang was opening for Led Bloody Zeppelin, the moon landing was also taking place, which seems sort of auspicious. The other history-making part around that era is that it is sometime in 1969 that Joe Walsh, for $500, sold one 1959 Les Paul Sunburst to Jimmy Page. Which, if y'all aren't familiar with Zeppelin, that is his number one. That is Jimmy Page's probably most played guitar. Very iconic. The sound is very recognizable, though, not to digress too much, but Jimmy Page credits Clapton with being the first one to, like, get that really deep, heavy sound by hooking up a Les Paul to, like, a big Marshall amp. So, that's part of the reason why the sound is so unique, and he credits, Clapton for coming up with that, combo. And that's not the only influential guitar that Joe Walsh would part with. A year later, Joe would give a 1959 Gretsch 6120 to Pete Townshend of The who the James Gang also opened for. Not quite as auspicious as a moon landing day, but they did open for The Who, and there was a lot of mutual respect between Townshend and Walsh, and Townshend isn't really known for giving out a lot of respect. So, and he was very complimentary of Walsh's playing. So that alone is impressive. Also, somewhere around this time, because Duane Allman would of course die in 1971, so somewhere prior, either in 70 or 71 or even before that, Duane Allman would teach Joe Walsh how to play slide guitar. And it very much shows that that was his instructor, because if you're familiar with Dwayne's work in Derek and the Dominoes, there's like those bird chirping sounding parts almost where he's playing on guitar at the near the ending of Layla, and the full length Layla, not the stupid radio edit where they chop it down to 4 minutes long, which makes me very angry. But like the full Layla, you get the little tweakings on the guitar at the end. It almost sounds like bird chirpings. And you'll hear similar slide guitar work and guitar work like that done by Joe Walsh. And so that, he had a very good instructor, probably one of the best slide guitar instructors one could ask for. I mean, it's Dwayne Allman of the Bloody Allman Brothers, so very cool there. I did not know that till I learned that today, and I was like, ah, that explains why I was mentally comparing the slide guitar work of those two in my head. But in 1971, Joe Walsh decided that he was done with the James Gang. He was tired of being like the predominant songwriter and the only player of a melodic instrument. So he just wanted to like kind of go somewhere where it was more of a band and less of a feeling like a solo artist with a backing band, because you're writing all the songs and doing all the creative musical stuff, because it's just bass and drums, and your bass player isn't somebody like Jack Bruce or John Paul Jones or even Jaco Pastorius, to go really out there. But anyway, so he starts a band called Barnstorm, which has this unfortunate thing that the record company advertises it as Barnstorm being like Joe Walsh's backing band. Like, they promoted these albums as solo albums that he did with Barnstorm, and really he's like, no, I'm part of this band. So that irritated him that the record companies were promoting the records as solo records. Hence why when you see Rocky Mountain Way like played on the radio, it's usually credited as Joe Walsh. Like, if you've got Sirius or the little display on your car and it tells you who's playing, they'll usually be like Joe Walsh, but it's actually Barnstorm. Barnstorm is who did Rocky Mountain Way. It's actually credited to all four of the band members. So it was very much a Barnstorm song, not a Joe Walsh song. But unfortunately, the record company didn't want to give credit where credit was due. And Joe did. That there's a lovely quote by him giving credit to the other band members and expressing his frustration at how the record company kind of cut them out of the spotlight that they deserved. So, also around this time, Joe did two collaborations with B.B. King on B.B. King albums. One was in 1970 called Indianola Mississippi Seeds, and obviously it's B.B. King, so it's great. And the album also features most of the songs that have piano. The piano is either played by these two no names you've never heard of, Leon Russell or Carole King. So that alone makes it kind of worth checking out. You've got Joe Walsh, Carole King, and Leon Russell playing with B.B. King. I mean, it's great to let just hear B.B. play by himself, much less when he's collabing with such notable people as Carole King and Leon Russell. Especially Leon Russell has really phenomenal piano playing skills. The other one was done in 1972. And it's called LA Midnight, and it was BB's 20th studio album. And the credits as personnel is a little less, eye-catching as far as like big names, other than Taj Mahal does play on harmonica. And of course, Joe Walsh plays guitar on some of the songs. So that was some of what Joe was up to in the early 70s. Now, in 1974, things take a less pleasant turn in Joe's life because his 3-year-old daughter dies in a car crash. If I remember the story correctly, she was on her way to go to preschool, and was in a fatal car crash. And that's actually what a song for Emma on Joe Walsh's solo album, So What, was in related to. Was a, you know, it was a song for his daughter Emma, who had passed. And the whole album of So What was kind of, the phrase kind of came up because he didn't really have any, he was very apathetic towards everything after losing his daughters, you know, kind of. So it was like, so what? Like, you know, he couldn't bring himself to care about much of anything after he lost his child, which is understandable. Also, an interesting instant around this time, and another time that Jimmy Page pops up in the life of Joe Walsh, is around this time that Joe, when he's writing Song for Emma, was hanging out in Florida. I believe it was. No, it was actually New York. Sorry. There's a photo of Jimmy and Joe in Florida, but the incident that I'm talking about was taking place in New York. It's recollected by a kind of super groupie, Lori Maddox. She was hanging out with Jimmy, and according to her, he stayed up like 2 nights straight with Joe. Like, didn't sleep for 48 hours, just trying to help Joe write the song. I don't know if it was a song for Emma or maybe a different song that Joe was trying to write to deal with his grieving. And Jimmy was helping him with that, which was, you know, really touching. Because, like, you hear all these negative stories about Led Zeppelin, but, you know, that's a lot of compassion on Jimmy's part to stay up with Joe and try and, you know, help him write this song to, you know, cope with the grief. Because I imagine, like, I'm not a musician, but, like, I do write fiction and things like that, and I do use it to cope with trauma and things. So I imagine their songwriting is typical the way I use my fiction writing. So, really admirable on Jimmy's part to be a good friend to Joe and help him through his hard times. And I'm so glad that there's, you know, record of that by Lori Maddox. It's actually in Pamela DeBarge's book, Let's Spend the Night Together, which is, you know, about all the wild, you know, hellion behavior of groupies and whatnot at the time. But I had heard it excerpted elsewhere and had to go look up the source. That's what I spent my Sunday morning doing. But anyway, so he had that. He also put up a fountain in the park that his daughter liked to play in. So sad tragedy there. Later on, of course, he joins the Eagles in 1975, in spite of concerns, especially by Don Henley, that Joe Walsh was, quote, too wild. I'm not going to get too much into his Eagles stuff because, you know, it's well known. He's on their two albums, Hotel California and In the Long Run. And, you know, before the Eagles split, those were his two things, and they sort of broke up in 1980. Also, in this interim, because, you know, that's only two albums in 5 years, he had to do other things with his life. He did Life's Been Good. The solo on the which is on his solo album, but what is it? The solo album, I forgot. Oh, But Seriously, Folks. And Life's Been Good did peak at number 12 on the chart, so it charted pretty highly. I think it's his highest charting hit to date, and I mean, it's one of my favorites. Like, I didn't even know it was a Joe Walsh song most of my life. I just really liked the whole, like, my Maserati goes 85. I mean, 185, and I lost my license, and now I don't drive. Like, it was really catchy. I've always liked the song. In 1980, he did the album There Goes the Neighborhood with A Life of Illusion as the only single on it, which is a pretty good song, too. And by the mid-80s, to take a dip back into the personal life, he was dating Stevie Nicks of Fleetwood Mac, who actually wrote the song Has Anyone Ever Written Anything For You? After Joe took her to the park where he put the fountain up, where his daughter had enjoyed playing. So, you know, still a part of his life, and it was really kind of sweet on Stevie Nicks's part to write a song, you know, for a little girl that she probably never met. So that was, you know, pretty sweet and kind of her. Also, in relation to his relationship with Stevie Nicks, the reason it ended Because according to Stevie, Joe was like the great love of her life. But Joe left her, not for like mean intentions, you know, it wasn't like heartbreak. It's just like they both had a really bad drug addiction at the time. And he kind of knew that they couldn't save each other and would just like, it would end up in mutually assured destruction. So he figured he was gonna get out in the hopes that, you know, they could get better if they weren't around each other, maybe. Which in the late 80s, while he was briefly in this band called Erbs, which is like a New Zealand Pacific reggae band, he went to Sacred Maori site and kind of had an epiphany. And between that and a couple other incidents in the following year or two, he really like firmly resolved to get sober and get off the drugs and get clean. So that's, you know, of course, fantastic news. Otherwise, you know, we might not still have him with us. But fortunately, he cleaned up his act. And, you know, if it's worth checking out some of the songs he did with Erbs and just Erbs' general music, like it's really cool. I like reggae, and I really like the voices, like the intonations and accents that Pacific Islanders have. So, really worth checking out. Herbs is cool, one of those hidden gems out there. So check out some Herbs for sure, with or without Joe. But anyway, so and then in 1990, he was in a band called The Best with Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and John Entwistle of The Who, and Jeff Skunk Baxter of Steely Dan, and the Doobie Brothers. So Baxter was in both those bands, and then Simon Phillips, who would actually, you know, be in Toto right before joining this band. He was in Toto for about 5 years, I think. So, you know, interesting lineup there, but definitely a big super group as far as like collected talent from various bands. I mean, you have a member of The Who in your band that kind of, even if you had nobody else from a previously existing famous band, that kind of make you a super group in of itself. And just the sweep and breadth of Joe Walsh's life. Like, I've just briefly given a history of his musical career and a few things of his personal life, not to mention his charity work and activism and things like that. And I mean, the man invented Vets Aid, which is huge. Granted, it's only been around about 5 years now, but still, I mean, he invented Vets Aid. That's pretty significant. And, you know, a lot more that could be looked into there. And just, I don't know him, obviously, but it feels like you have to be somewhat humble to collaborate with this many people. Like, obviously, he did the collaborations with B.B. King, and he's in that super group, and a lot of other collaborations going on. Fogelberg, lots of people. I mean, he's collaborated with everybody from Kenny Chesney to Warren Zevon, and yet he still claims to be the average Joe. Like, the average Joe is his nickname, though it seems like somewhat of a misnomer when you look at his career and his life. So, we are here wishing the way above average, average Joe, the happiest of birthdays, and next week you'll get to hear all about Stevie Van Zandt and his birthday and his life achievements, and I may make it entirely about why I admire Stevie so much, and a little bit about his musical career too. But get ready for the Stevie Van Zandt love train coming through at like full speed next week, and I will see y'all next week. In the meantime, be kind to each other and rock on.